him troubling you. And the reason he does it with me, and it may be different with you, but is because I have a conscience that got shaped and built upon and formed in a variety of ways. And if I really agree with Leo's call for dealing with reality. And so one of the realities that I have to deal with is this conscience that's festering away inside of me and giving me all kinds of feelings of joy and guilt and direction and rejection. And I think that each one of us have to, you know, take a look at that conscience. Now, I'm not of a mind that this thing was somehow sacredly dropped into me, formed and given by God so that it's a perfect thing. If my understanding is correct, it's been shaped by my mother and father and friends and church, and that's how it got there. And some of those people are fallible, and that conscience may be all screwed up and telling me all kinds of, you know, irrelevant or dubious sorts of directions. But nonetheless, it's there. It's mine, and it's the one I've got to live with. And this is where Gill's plea for a theology, you know, because that's, I guess, the way my conscience reacts. It responds to theology. It responds to God and that whole God question. So I, you know, it would just be a cry that my conscience now needs some theology to give it direction and guidance. And before I can personally act on the question of abortion, even though my head, I think, is with four members of the panel, my conscience sits with Peter, and his speaking always brings back the memory that I've tried to bury about this conscience of mine. Gil Splatt.
All, please, when you take the microphone, say your name so that if we do transcribe this, we can make it accurate. Unless you want to remain anonymous, then you don't need to.
As a speech teacher, sometimes I ought to know better or be better equipped to clarify my ideas than what I seem to do. But from the questions that came to me during the break, I realized that I wasn't as precise as I should have been. And I want to make that point very clear. I was talking about personal conscience, not about policy or, you know, impinging that conscience upon other people. But when one makes a decision, one needs to make that decision in a way in which his own personal conscience can live with it. And what I was simply crying for, I guess, is help for my conscience. Because my mind has now come to the point where, you know, I agree with Dr. Baker and the others on the panel in terms of the necessity for and the validity for and all that for abortion. But my conscience, you know, maybe yours isn't in that place, and that's fine. But my conscience is not ready to go on it. And I can look back at the kind of training and theology that was piped into that conscience that makes it that way. And so then I was calling simply for more theology to help my conscience, you know, get straight with my head, put it all together, as they say. And I think a lot of what I hear when we get troubled by people like Father Hagel is that he's stirring up the memory of our conscience, that many of us, you know, can really subdue that thing and bury it until it comes face to face with the issue. And I think this dealing with reality, we have to deal with who we are, what our history has been, how we've gotten to the point that we're at, and that's part of our personal realities. And it has nothing to do with legalization and the whole process there. I think, you know, I'd say legalize because people have varieties of conscience. And for a lot of people, that's no issue at all. It just is for me and maybe for you.
The next speaker is Barbara Collins.
I would like to make a few more comments on some things that I think bear upon the problem that we're talking about. First off, concerning life, this has been one of the hang-ups, when does life occur and otherwise. And first, I'd like to speak to this, and I'd like to get back to the idea of conscience that was just mentioned. But first, concerning life, maybe we could ask the other question, what is death? When is somebody dead? When is someone not living? We would think, first off, that these are two, in other words, life or death, one or the other. Okay, this is also, can be another problem. In other words, when is somebody no longer living? When do you turn off the heart-lung machine? When is life suddenly stopped? Okay. True, this is probably not adequately clarified, but I'll ask when. Maybe when the heart stops beating. Perhaps some of you will decide this, but yet maybe the heart isn't beating and we can get it to beating again. Or perhaps a better definition would be when we no longer have a brain pattern. But anyway, we have to make this decision. In other words, when someone is no longer living. But either case, it is probably either the heart or the brain. Yet the fertilized embryo, you see, does not have either a heart or a brain. There is no registered heartbeat. There is no registered brainwave. And yet, is this living or not? This is just a little question. Okay. Secondly, concerning the idea of conscience, we've got to consider if we're bringing this life into the world. In other words, what kind of a life is it going to be, not for this individual, but as Leo brought out, in other words, what is going to be the life after it is born? What type of quality of life is it going to have? And we have to consider that individual plus also the other individuals around, I think, that also have to be considered. In other words, we're making a judgment here. But I think maybe it's people, maybe we don't want to make this judgment, but we've got to. And we are already making judgments like this all the time, conscience judgments on what kinds of decisions, and we're going to have to make them more and more. We've got to come up to this particular problem. Supposing, for example, you're a bus driver. You've got 30 people in the bus. You're driving on a very relatively narrow road or otherwise. There's somebody suddenly, maybe it's a dark night, suddenly you see somebody in front of you. You've got, in the middle of the road, you've got two choices. One, you either hit the person, probably kill them, destroy life, or the only other alternative, you veer off the road. If you do this, the bus will go over. You'll kill 30 people instead. I mean, this is a value judgment instead, but I think, I mean, it's the kind of thing that we're doing all the time. You've got to make these, and maybe this might enter into a very excellent book that deals with some of these problems that we do have to meet. Has been written by Leroy Augenstein, Come, Let Us Play God. In other words, we are playing God. We have been. When you take antibiotics, you are, and so on. These are things that we have to deal with.
Are we supposed to identify ourselves also? Father Hagel? You know, some people don't even like to discuss this issue of abortion because they feel that we are in a crisis situation, as in the middle of the road, dark night, when we've got to jump. I think even in this week where we are studying ecology, I think we've got to admit that we are in the mess that we are in because we have not given prior due consideration to the advances of our technology. We have simply gone hog wild without thinking and looking forward. That's why we are where we are today. If 50 years ago, 25 years ago, they would have looked forward to pollution and dumping junk into the water and smoke into the air, we wouldn't be where we are today. Now, are we not basically doing the same thing with this very vital issue of abortion? We need to look forward to see the repercussions that this is going to have on the quality of life that we're so concerned about, and validly so. But what we are trying to do, we have an immediate problem here. Jump. Take this road. Answer it in this method without giving due consideration to the other. And then with Gil, what Gil said about, you know, he knows where his head is, but his conscience is in a different place. I feel personally, just as an individual, I wish I could change my conscience. I wish I could find rational justification for abortion. It would be a way to deal with some of the problems with the crippled, the insane, and so on that are problems for us right now. But my rationale, where I stand intellectually, won't let me do that.
Ivan, I'd like to direct a return question to Father Hagel. I would ask him, how long would you wait before you make a decision? Aren't we, by not acting, essentially making a decision? Or would we wait a year? Would we wait 2 years? I think your own church, by waiting, what are the figures? 1 week, 2 weeks, for every week you delay on birth control, for example, there is the equivalent of another Rome in the world. Aren't you making the decision here also by not acting? So I guess the question is, how long would you wait and see? How long would you wait to see what the safe course is, when by waiting the problem becomes more acute? As Dr. Hampton mentioned, we're on a logarithmic pattern of growth. We really can't afford to wait very long. I would be interested in hearing your answer to that.
Father Hagel.
First, let me take one part of one thing that you said about this business. I'm sorry I even mentioned that Tutsir Pars bit. because this is not really... I brought that in hoping to, back in Augustine's time and so on, when they did not have science developed to the degree that we have today to tell us about biology and so on, and they weren't sure when life began. They took quickening, you know, in that position there. And then the church follows this principle, just not in this, in everything really. It's a moral, theological principle applied to any situation where there is doubt. And it's usually applied mostly in the administration of the sacraments. For example, comes this person, I want to join the church. Well, have you been baptized? And we respect any valid baptism, regardless of what denomination it may have taken place in. Well, I don't know. Well, can we find out? Turns out we can't find out. The person doesn't know. A serious thing here at issue, baptism or non-baptism. There's doubt. We don't know. So we follow the safer course and end up with what is called conditional baptism. But now, I say, I don't think we need to apply this principle of Tutsir Pars to the abortion issue. I say, let's listen to science. Science is developed and developing to the degree where they can give us more certainty, where we don't have to apply the principle which deals with uncertainty. According to science, life begins, really. As this conference concluded, this International Congress on Abortion, the only logical place to say that life begins is at conception, because it's a continuum, etc., etc. Now,
How long do we wait? I say, let's not wait at all. All I ask for is that we look at all aspects of it and just not make up our mind before we think or jump before we think. I think serious, objective, sharing of ideas. And the church recognizes, you know, even the church in the Catholic Church in the state of Washington recognizes, we'll do what we can to let you share our views with you, and it's all going to be decided in November. And we recognize that even if the law is liberalized, Catholics don't have to have abortions. It's not imposing abortion on anyone, but for the good of our, you know, we love our country, we love our society, we want its good. We feel that we want to share with you these considerations before we possibly go ahead and legalize it, which is going to lead to other things. So I say, no, we don't have to wait a year, 2 years. It's simply, let's listen to one another. In a day like this, in a panel like this, closed ears. Nobody wants to hear the other side of the story.
Dr. David Hampton.
I'd like to say something about the problem of conscience. I think, again, physical or biological scientists sometimes come off without a conscience for some reason, maybe because of the way in which ends are approached here. But the the statement was made that that Father Hagel seems to sharpen a conscience. He renews a conscience that I have for concern for the unborn. But we do have to make decisions about, in terms of our conscience, about those who have been born. And this can be a conscience matter also, and a theology matter. And therefore, another problem with the statement made about developing a theology of this whole matter. Unfortunately, the theology development sometimes takes considerable time, and I don't believe that the statistics say that we do have that amount of time. And let me make it clear that I do not endorse abortion as the only means of birth control. I prefer contraception, the techniques to be improved and developed, and I think that abortion is a means by which we can control until the time that we have a contraceptive effectiveness that would enable us to decline or diminish the amount of abortion taking place. I think abortion in terms of the mechanics on how it's carried out is also a problem. At what time should an abortion take place? Should it take place when the fetus is being formed, let's say 5 weeks, before 5 weeks? Should it take place at 12 weeks, where the fetus begins to look like a human being? Should it take place at 20 weeks or 28 weeks, when quickening or self-sufficiency takes place in terms of the fetus? And I would think that, or I would favor that we should start and permit abortion before the time of the 20th or 28th week, and that we can only take this stepwise, but you would have to remind yourself that inaction is a form of action here. We don't have the opportunity, the length of time, the prospect of delaying our decision. The decision is being made at this very hour. 6,000 people, you see, per hour.
Dr. Baker.
We went a bit tangentially into conscience. And before we leave it, I'd like to say another word about conscience. I think that it's not entirely tangential, because it is related, really, to a decision that we're discussing here. Sometimes conscience is defined as the seat of truth. Conscience is seen by some people as the that part of the self which gives one the correct judgment about what is right and wrong. One trouble with this point of view is that what is right and wrong varies tremendously, not only from culture to culture, but among people within a given culture. There obviously is no such thing as a universally true conscience. Conscience is the capacity of the organism to respond to punishment or praise. It's exactly the same thing you see in your pet dog when you catch him doing something that you punished him for previously. He recognizes he's been caught, or he recognizes the disapproving tone in your voice, and he tucks his tail between his legs and crawls toward you for more punishment. Or in another case, it may be a praise and so on. It's exactly the same way at the human level. We eventually internalize the praise versus punishment that our significant others have treated us with, and soon we have an internalized punishment praise capacity, which is conscience. The content of that conscience depends then, as Gill pointed out, upon the complex interaction of his association with parents, other significant others, the culture as a whole, including one's religion. The conscience, therefore, does not lead one to right decisions. If the human animal is any different from other animals, it at least is at this point that he does have the increased capacity to act rationally. If we are therefore to be more than, better than, above other animal forms, it is at least at the point where we inform our conscience, where we change our conscience when reason indicates we ought to change it, and that we make our decisions on a rational basis.
Bill Jeffs also has some comments related to conscience and what he previously spoke to us about.
I don't want to let these be long. What I keep hearing here is that we're talking about the quality of the kind of fetus that we're going to produce and pour out into the world. This morning is really on abortion. We've made it population control, in a sense, a very real sense. I think we have done an injustice to the topic for that reason. What I'm most concerned about, and I apparently didn't do a very good job of explaining that, is my concern for those of us that exist now and the quality of life that we have. You may call that selfishness, you may call it whatever you wish, but I think we have a responsibility that where prevention, especially of cripples being born into the world, and those who are normal, born into a sociological situation which could cripple them, that we have a responsibility of conscience, if you will, to exercise good judgment and not to allow that to happen. Now, I personally am very much concerned about a pro-life kind of approach to this whole business of abortion. I do not feel that it can be used as a number one population controlling device, as many students with whom I come in contact with would like to have it be. I do feel, however, that those of us that do exist have to reevaluate the kind of toll that either overpopulation will take sociologically and cripple us as a society and as individuals, or that de facto cripples will bring into the whole business of family, community, etc. I want to give you two examples. One was economics. Economics was brought up. With Down syndrome, mongolism, we have about 70% of the retarded that are in the United States. State of California, this cost to institutionalize $470 per month per person. Just on the basis of good old economics, even Ronald Reagan can understand that. What are we doing here? Resources. What are we doing here family-wise? When we have tools to prevent that. The other consideration is, and I'll give you a personal example. talk about conscience. The problem of conscience doesn't stop with what kind of fetus are we going to produce and what kind of child is going to be born into the world, either sociologically or biologically. It continues on. My wife and I right now face the whole business of sterilization of a child who's 12 years old in puberty and now can reproduce. That is a matter of conscience too. And so these kind of considerations must be a part of our whole outlook on the part this whole issue of abortion. It's not just simply what kind of fetus we produce, but what kind of ongoing drain, psychological, emotional, if you will. And if we're, say we're weak people, we're weak people, that's all. But damn it, we've got to face that society, and somebody mentioned poverty, certainly this, coupled with age and a lot of other factors, we have to face that these issues are continuous and that the conscience situation doesn't just stop with whether or not we're going to produce a fetus or not. So I only implore you to think about the life situation of those who already exist and have that a part of consideration as far as the whole issue of abortion is concerned.
I'm Verlin Smith. I asked Chuck for an opportunity to take this mic because I'd like to suggest a very, if you'll excuse the expression, pregnant idea that is not mine but comes from John Moore, who is a Methodist campus pastor at Sacramento State College in California. Some of you may have read an article which Moore published recently in Christian Century, and some of the things that he said in that article will be repeated in what I'll have to say, but actually his article was not as explicit as some of my discussions with him have been. And it relates to this matter of conscience. Moore is operating on this kind of background, first that he believes, from his experience as a pastor and counselor with girls and guys who have been involved in situations looking forward toward abortions and so on, that the people who come through this experience in the most healthy way, he insists, are the people who have been able to say that in the abortion, they have indeed taken a life. Not that they've simply stopped some kind of chemical process or, you know, removed some kind of blob of protoplasm or whatever, but the people who have been able to say, yes, we have indeed, and we are indeed taking a life. Life now defined not in terms of whether it wiggles and squirms or that kind of stuff, but life determined or life defined as potential. The fertilized egg has a potential that the lonely egg does not have, at least yet. And the lonely sperm certainly does not have, at least yet. Okay, that's one background comment. The other comment is that Moore and his associates are very much concerned about the kind of thing that Father Hagel has very courageously said to us, and I'm grateful that he's here, and that is a concern that as we liberalize abortion laws, we also cheapen the value of human life. Whether we define it originally as sacred or what our terminology is, and what the ultimate outcome of that kind of cheapening process might be. Okay, the proposal is, and this is one that I think as a Christian community we can ponder, that we ought to develop in the church a rite, R-I-T-E, of abortion, such as the rite of baptism or the rite of confirmation or the funeral rite or the marriage rite, a rite of abortion, that the young woman and, in many cases, young man involved enter into the experience of abortion with the kind of seriousness which at least the church would like to have people enter into such things as marriage, and the kind of seriousness that the church at least would like to treat death, and so on. A rite in which there would be a very explicit confession of the ambiguity of what is about to take place. The uncertainties that we feel, conscience. We're boxed in. We're in a context in which we make a decision which we admit is probably the lesser of a bunch of evils rather than a clear and unambiguous good. And having made that kind of confession, ask God, who is the giver of life and all good things, to go with us into and through that experience, and to once again recognize the reality of grace and forgiveness and the ongoingness of life despite our uncertainties. I think that's an exciting idea, and one we might ponder. Okay?
Next speaker is Kathy Bosch, B-O-S-C-H.
Is there anyone that wants to respond to this idea before we have another question?
Kathy Bosch. Thank you, Verlin. About half an hour ago, I wanted to make part of the same statement, that we do have a God of forgiveness and a God of grace, and that he has given us our free will and a conscience that we are to use as we best see in our situation. Now, I'm not sure how I would make a decision if after the two children I do have, I find myself pregnant with a third. That's my conscience. I cannot have my church decide it for me, however, because they are not going to have to come into my house and work with my budget and work with the time and the abilities that I have in being able to put some good potential into my children. It's not just the potential of the egg and the sperm fertilized. It's what we do with it. And this is one of the things that our state is not legislating. The state may legislate that you drive a certain speed, that you pass at certain times, that you have to pass a certain test to drive, but it is not legislating how well you can feed your children, how much love you can give them, what moral conscience you can help develop in them. You know, it says something when children are beaten too severely and you can tell that they've been beaten, then they're taken away from the parents. But it doesn't say a lot of other things in between that does help make the child the good, use it to its high potential, or to keep it at a very low, mediocre, poor citizen. But this is why I don't think the state can legislate to me or to anyone else that they are my conscience and say, no, you can't have an abortion, or yes, you can. It can say, okay, we'll allow you this free will, the same free will that God has given us. And it's coming and going on top of God and saying, no, in these areas you can't have your free will. Because all situations are the same, therefore they all have to be dealt with, and because one section of the population cannot accept an abortion, therefore none of you can. That's taking away my free will and the use of my conscience. Now, I might decide not to, but I might decide to have an abortion. And for someone who's 16 or 35 or 45, who finds himself in the position of pregnant with a husband, without a husband, I don't think that really I feel very strongly against this, and I probably am a great moralist in this. And about 6 years ago, we discovered a situation of some very close student who had gotten someone else pregnant, and they went through an abortion. And at that time, I was just vehement. If she got herself in this situation, she can get herself out of it. And her response was, "What I do is my own damn business." Now, 6 years have mellowed me a lot, so I would say a lot to this whole gap of generation. It's not just age, it's a state of feeling. At this time, I would probably have been more sympathetic and more helpful to her than I was at that time. But I do think we have to rely on our God as a God of forgiveness and a God who has given us the free will to make the decision that seems best in our situation. And I think it's very unfortunate that the same legislatures who will probably vote down the amendment for abortion are probably the same ones who sit on the Selective Service Board and say, "You all have to go and shoot a communist." That this is entirely unfair, unjust, unequal, and a whole variety of other adjectives that I cannot think of at this time. These are my feelings. And that if we can't feel that our God is a God of forgiveness, then we have a very poor God. And if a person finds himself in a situation that she does need an abortion, but is in a state that said, "No, I'm going to be your God," and say, "You can't have one," then I'm very sorry for the people in that state, because it's usually the people that need them the most that are not able to get them. And so they bring some children into the world. I'm a family life specialist. And I realize what's happening with families, and particularly with families that have too many children already. And they're not on the farm where they can send each one out with a hoe to dig his own little plot and be helpful to the family. That they're the ones that are going to get our country into even greater problems than it's in now, because they won't have the education, they won't have the ability to do a variety of things. They may be the ones that decide they can get their prestige and their ego from selling drugs and pushing other people into it, or get on it, and so then they have to start stealing or killing, robbing, in order to get money to do some of these things. I think that's more toward the angle of what may possibly happen if we don't have the free will to decide by our conscience whether we have an abortion or not. And I do believe in a God of forgiveness. And I do believe in Luther's statement, or if it was actually his or not, saying, you know, you sin boldly. Maybe it's not the best decision that you've made. But if it's one that you have to make because you have to live with it, then you pray to your God of greatness for his forgiveness, and then live with the assurance that we do have a God that forgives those who earnestly seek for his forgiveness, and live in that grace, or else we have a God without grace. And I don't believe in that kind of God.
Dick Jurgensen, DeKalb, and I perhaps should not stand up to refute somebody, especially when they're popular, as is indicated by the first applause today. But you compare it with the requirement to shoot somebody in Vietnam. Instead of a much closer analogy, how about the right under a forgiving God to kill the one-year-old child that I might have who is definitely deformed, instead of a potential child that might be deformed? I'm disturbed on this whole issue, and I've been in the ambiguities of it in politics too. And I don't think it's as simple as we have been implying, that it's a matter of being rational as opposed to an irrational conscience or emotion. I'm not at all convinced that the arguments for abortion are rational, the arguments against it are not. I think there's an awfully great desire in this generation, where we've been living with science, we've been able to control everything, that we want to control things and live very simply without the consequence. And if this is to be rational, if we have abortion, we have to take into account what it does to a people in the future. I suppose if I have a quarrel with the generation that calls itself the now generation, It might be in this area, which is, again, not a good thing to bring out if I want to influence you. But the whole concept of now only is terribly dangerous. How will I feel tomorrow and next week and next month and next year or when I grow old? Here we talk so casually with arguments that can be used to justify aborting an embryo, 90% of which will apply to killing somebody we do not like living on the earth. And I think we only need to point to history, where at one time we could easily have solved the problem of Father Hegel, because he, being a Roman Catholic, it would be legitimate reason enough to have him killed. Of course, then we can go to another country where I would be the lone Protestant, and it would be reason enough to kill me. I was a Democratic senator in North Dakota, where the majority of people would not have been too appalled at the death of Democrats. Now, there are other states where it could be the opposite. What I'm saying is, we have to live by principles a little bit in this thing, bring them into account. And by the way, I'm not completely one-sided on this. There's situations where I imagine I would vote for abortion. But the argument that God forgives me so we can wipe out the embryo, God forgives me if I kill my grown daughter or my wife too, you know. But there are few of us who would argue that that means that it's justifiable to do so. I don't want to speak too long, but I think we have to avoid trying to think of an expedient answer right now. The only way to mine here was to dump the dirt out here, and there it sits. You know, we complain about it, but we dump our garbage up near it. We have to think in terms of the overall long range. And the basic problem for some of us who are disturbed by this thing is the problem, and we cannot overlook the question of when life begins, because that's crucial as to whether or not we're respecting life or not. Now, there are times when it might be kind in respecting life to destroy somebody. My father died of stomach cancer. It's a type of disease where it could be quite kind. My brother died of another form of cancer where the pain becomes so great that even though drugged as heavily as they could drug a person will often rip their skin trying to scratch the pain. Maybe we should take a life, but as soon as we begin, we open a door that is mighty dangerous.
I'm Paul Nylander. I have three questions for Father Hegel. First, considering yourself as a civilian without any religious teachings at all, could you approve of an abortion that would save the physical life of a mother? Second, in your official function as a priest, could you ever counsel a couple to practice contraception other than rhythm or abstention? And third, when the Pope made the declaration in the summer of 68 concerning contraception and birth control, was that the kind of a decree where papal infallibility was involved? And if so, could it ever be reversed by another decree?
Excuse me, I'd like to intercede for a moment. I think Kathy wants to respond to what Dick said, and before we launch onto a new question.
Peter Hegel.
Three very succinctly put questions, but I'd like to respond to Kathy first. Twice you've been put off now. Kathy, I tried to make a point earlier, which I think is valid. The decision-making power that you want, I don't think can legitimately be given to you, because to give that decision-making power to you has tremendous implications on all of society, not just on you. Therefore, we must share with you in somehow arriving at what we're going to do in your situation. So I would be afraid. I, as a private citizen, would be afraid for myself and for my environment to give you, to hand over to you, that type of absolute power. That scares the death out of me, or the life out of me. Now, your three questions. First, as a citizen, aside from my church, my priesthood, anything else, no. I think for our safety, for the safety of, and this isn't the Tutsir Pars thing, for the good of our society and for the quality, the protection of the quality of life, I think I would have to say several things here. First, I must uphold the sacredness of life. That this, and I'll, you know, if science is going to tell us, as it does now, incidentally, that the only logical place that we can say life begins is at conception. We can't say three. That's purely arbitrary to do that. Logically, they say, we've got to say it's at conception. So I have to uphold that, okay, here is a human being. And this human being has the right to life. So does the mother. And we've got to quit playing God. And we have to allow nature, and I'm getting pious and all religious junk now, allow God's will also to be fulfilled in and through nature. And this, incidentally, just a little corollary to this, I'm opposed, really opposed, to what we are doing at the other end of life. This fantastic thing that we're trying to do to prolong it, to keep the dying alive to the last minute. No, we should stop this nonsense. And I agree with many others here. We should stop that and do what he says and what the Pope himself has said. Let's spend time and money and our technology to find out good ways of preventing conception that are acceptable and not dangerous medically and so on. Huh? He pleaded for this research for contraception. So I would say no, I think I could not say, because if I do it in that case, I got to do it in that case, and I'm contradicting myself. Secondly, yes, as a priest, and I counsel responsible parenthood. You have as many children as you've think you can raise in dignity, which means properly feed, clothe, educate, take care of, and keep in mind your responsibility to the human community also and the population problem. Practice birth control. Means, method, makes no difference, be it the condom, the pill, whatever you want. Third, and I do that second one because the Encyclical Humanae Vitae of 1968 is not an infallible document. The Pope we see as the chief teacher of the Catholic Church. We listen to him with seriousness, but no, we do not need to accept as a matter, an article of faith, what he says, such as in that encyclical. That's why there is much disagreement with him. Much of what he said, I believe to be valid, but, that's a very interesting thing that, and, you know, if we had another 2 or 3 hours just to knock birth control around and why he took the position he did on it and why I take the position I take on it. Does that answer?
Dr. Baker?
One brief comment. Peter, I just get really uptight with what seems to me to be a sacrilegious approach to God. The idea that two young people, half drunk, have intercourse and conceive a child is an act of God, I see as utter blasphemous.
Um, the act of conception, the act of intercourse, is a human act. The course which nature takes has God working within it. God works in and through nature. How can I, therefore, really say that God created me? He did not. My mom and dad had intercourse, their sperm, ovum. How can I say God created me? Because God's will is embedded in the laws of biology. And nature followed its course. The laws of biology came into effect, which was God's will there. No, it would be blasphemous for me to say, you two went out and committed a sin, fornication, and God blessed you with this child. No, that's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But I also hear, and I think this is important, what are we doing? Are we, in many instances, are we simply trying to find ways out, ways to justify the irresponsibility of people? Are we catering to the delinquency of mankind? Are we making it easy for man to be irresponsible? And I think we've got too much of that already. Pardon? Do I believe in magic? No. What, God, the laws of nature, and so on? Pardon?
Father Hegel?
Bill Jeffs asks, is this my view of the laws of nature, God's will being embedded in the laws of nature? Is this not magic? Is this not a naturalistic theology? All I can say, Bill, is where did those laws come from? The laws of physics, the laws of astronomy, the laws of chemistry. Where did they come from? Who put them there? Why does this operate in this way? Good question. But did God determine when he created that when this happens and man, with or without responsibility, does or doesn't do this, this happens or it doesn't happen? Who decided that? Do I decide that? No. If I implant my seed, I can be pretty sure nature's going to take its course. And I didn't decide that. That's predetermined. And I say it's predetermined by God. And it's not magic at all. It's simply nature following its course as God planned it. And in that way, I'm not saying that God sits up there and says, oh yes, now I will, and I go along with this. No. I see it this way. God said, here is the wonderful creature I'm going to create. Here is how he's going to propagate himself. And when he does this, this shall happen, that shall happen.
Barbara Collins.
I'd like to make one other comment about nature following its course. If we follow this philosophy, then I think it should be right that we, even if we have pneumonia, refuse to take an antibiotic. This is not nature. It is something you're doing outside, and maybe did God plan it this way? I mean, it's something that's additional.
Father Hegel?
That's a very good consideration, because I wasn't born with these glasses either, nor were those who are wearing contacts born with those things in your eyes, nor hearing aids, nor false teeth, etc., etc. The difference in these things are that these, I have many faculties or powers given to me by nature, the faculty of vision, the faculty of hearing, and so on. For one reason or another, these faculties become deficient and therefore I resort to an artificial thing to help the faculty achieve its objective better than it can by itself. Whereas the opposite is true, for example, in cases of birth control, for example, or abortion. We are not allowing and helping nature to take its course. We are contradicting, stopping the faculty from achieving its goal or its objective or that for which it was put in us. There's a difference here. One is to help the faculties achieve their objective. The other is simply to contradict them and prevent them.
Joe Addison, you've already spoken to the main point I was going to raise, the idea of us playing God. And I think that at least my wife, who's a registered nurse, tells me that many of the problem pregnancies we have today wouldn't have occurred many years ago because the woman would have been dead a long time ago. That even brings up this question of the possibility of abortions in order to save the mother's life and some of the other situations. So I think that there may be times when we're going to have to play God, picking up some of the kinds of dimensions that we've already lived out in our lives. But I want to shift then to the other question I had, which was a legal one, I suppose, in our society. It's true that when we run into a decision like this, we tend to take votes on it, and the majority do win and get their particular laws passed. But also, in our democracy, we've been very concerned about protecting the rights of minority opinions, particularly those that are based on moral decisions and on ethical decisions. We have recognized that within our Constitution. We've recognized it, I think, throughout society. Under our present circumstances, those who in good conscience feel they must have an abortion, and there are those, as practicing Christians, who feel that, cannot legally do so. They are stymied. Under liberalized abortion laws, both sides would be able to exercise their moral options. And from what I understand about morality, the implication is that it must be a free choice. Morality cannot be legislated. Surface obedience to a certain set of laws can be legislated. But within our Christian ethical systems, we must recognize that it must be a free option. I cannot force my wife to love me. I can maybe force her legally to live with me. But I would like the free option in that situation.
Father Hegel?
Word response to that. I agree with you. And this is a question about maybe the law, this should be taken completely out of the legal realm and not even, you know, just repeal everything we got regarding abortion and leave it up to individuals. But the question of serious concern is this: what pedagogic value does a law have? You see, our laws embed and teach what we as a society and as a civilization stand for and hold sacred. It sort of spells out in writing what our priorities are. And that's why lawyers are very afraid of, you know, completely removing it from the legal area at all, because they feel we're going to lose a great teaching, manifesting device here if we don't write it into a law.
The next speaker is Talia Cady. Thalia Cady.
Now we have.
I think a little earlier we were talking about responsibility, Talia Cady. I think a little earlier we were talking about responsibility and the fact that liberalized abortion laws may contribute to irresponsibility. What I'd like to talk about now is responsibility and murder. You know, we've all heard that we shall not kill, but there are many ways to kill. There are many different murders that we can commit. I've seen too many children who have been brought into a world where they are not loved. In effect, these children have experienced a kind of death. I've seen autistic children. I've seen children with emotional problems because they've been brought into a world where they were not wanted and where people did not feel they needed a child to love. I've heard too many stories about women who have had butcher shop abortions because our society tells them that they cannot have a legal, they cannot have a safe abortion. I've heard too many stories of the deaths of these women. I think indirectly, our society has contributed to the death of these women. In effect, our society has helped murder them because they forced them into a butcher shop abortion. I think I've seen too many of the living dead and too many accounts of the dead to say that it's an irresponsible act to allow a legal abortion.
Adam Cottrell, I hear people talking about the law.
About the law. And, you know, the law somehow illustrating where our priorities are. I have serious reserves about that. From where I stand, the law only represents a certain perspective from a certain group. And it has been far too long that all and most of the laws have been oriented to the concerns and the lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, of one group of people. Speaking for myself, you know, as a black person, I can understand why a black woman would resort to having an abortion. You know, what hope is there in bringing a child in the world where you know he's going to have to go through what you've gone through, where he cannot be brought into a world where he can be respected, where he can have dignity, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I have real trouble with accepting the fact that the law stands for, you know, the people and their priorities. The whole idea of abortion, you know, and the whole idea of birth control is oriented towards a certain group. The people who really need the service can't get it in the main. The people who really need the birth control devices can't get it because of society standards. The family practice center, they come up and they set up their birth control center and they make arbitrary laws as to who can get birth control devices. Married woman, unless otherwise prescribed by a doctor. Well, this sounds cool, you know, but in reality, everyone turns around and they look at black America and they say, hey, look, they have the highest illegitimate childbirth rate. And that rate does not come from, you know, people who are of marrying age. It comes from earlier ages. Girls, I know too many girls, 15, 14, 13, who have to drop out of school because, you know, they've had a baby. You know, I think we're going to have to reconsider this whole thing and really do some serious analyzing of where our laws are and who they do speak for before we can take that kind of approach.
Father Hagel?
That, what I said about the law and its teaching value, etc., is not my position, personally. I was just pointing out that this is a consideration, and that's why lawyers don't want to go along with those people who say, let's take it completely out of the realm of law and leave it up to the individual people. They say, no, we should keep the law because it teaches, etc., etc. I don't necessarily go along with that, and I agree with what you say here. You know, usually, don't the laws and reflect the opinion of the majority, which is, and Catholics are a minority, the law reflects the majority opinion and view, which is a white, middle-class Protestant view. It always has been. I can understand as a... In the United States, I was in the same position, my forefathers were in the same position that you are. In New York City, I am told that this was fact. Sign in the window of a cafe or something. Help wanted. Negro, Irish, Catholic, Jew, need not apply. You see, we were discriminated against also. Aren't we discriminated against even? I feel we are. Our children cannot even ride the buses because they're Catholic and their parents decided to send them to Catholic school. They cannot ride the public school buses, even though my parents, I, pay for those damn buses. Yet our children cannot ride those buses. So there is discrimination, and there's always going to be, I suppose, if the law is such that it reflects always the majority opinion.